Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Fed announced plans to monitor pay packages at thousands of banks. The Treasury Department ordered compensation cuts for executives at seven companies that received bailout money. In the health care debate, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he may include a public option in the health care bill that he'll take to the Senate floor. And the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi threatened to remove an antitrust exemption for insurance companies. Joining me in the studio for the Friday News Roundup, Byron York of The Washington Examiner, Susan Page of USA Today, and David Korn of PoliticsDaily.com. Are you still with Mother Jones?
Yes. No, please, otherwise I'll be in big trouble.
All right,
Mother Jones, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief, and a columnist from PoliticsDaily.com.
All right, we've got it all now, and we can also include our listeners. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email and make sure you remind us that David Korn is with Mother Jones. Let's talk about pressure for a public option growing among Democrats, Susan.
You know, a month ago, it looked like the public option was entirely washed away by the effort to get some Republican votes and to hold moderate Democrats. It's been revived to some extent. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is trying to see if he can put an option, a public option, a government-run health care plan to compete with private insurers in the version that the Senate's going to consider, with a provision that states could opt out. Now, I think there's some skepticism about whether this will fly. Not only would you lose Olympia Snowe, the one Republican vote, who supported the Senate finance plan when it was came up in committee. There's also the risk that you would lose a couple of moderate Democrats, people like Evan Bayh or Mary Landrieu or Ben Nelson of Nebraska. And so I continue to be skeptical that this is what is going to be in the final bill. But its prospects are brighter now than they were a couple weeks ago.
I agree with Susan on that. Proponents of a public option were very heartened this week by this Washington Post poll, which seemed to show strong public support for this public option. Was it 57%, I think?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. However, I should say that a Gallup poll from the same time with, I thought, a better sample showed 50-46 in favor of a public
that
option.
That was a USA Today Gallup
poll. I should say that.
Susan was making phone calls on that, actually.
So it shows almost a straight down the middle division on a public option. I think there was perhaps a little bit of irrational enthusiasm on behalf of on behalf of what's called the robust public option, which is what Nancy Pelosi and a lot of people in the House would like. It seems to me that the only version of a public option that's still really possible is this so-called trigger public option, where there is not one immediately, but if the government determines that health care is not widely available enough or affordable enough, then the public option kicks in.
David Korn, what about the idea of a public option where states, individual states, can opt out? Does that make sense?
Well, that's one of the things that Harry
there
Reid...
There are three there, aren't there?
That Harry Reid is exploring, whether you could have this and have states opt out. Seems to me that, all those state rights advocates on Capitol Hill should say that's fine. If a state can opt out, then it's not an issue unless you want to protect the insurance industry. Right now, it's clear that on the House side, they're near majority support for a public option. Nancy Pelosi says she almost has 218 votes. Within days, she might. On the Senate side, there probably are over 50 votes for a public option. So let's take a step back here and say, hey, it is a majority position in Washington in the legislative branch. So all this dithering, as Dick Cheney might say, about this stuff is really about obstructionism and whether Republicans and a few moderate Democrats, because they don't like it and because they're in the minority, can use the system as it exists to block this.
Susan.
Well, you know, it's very frustrating to people who support the public option to look at just what you're saying. Majority support in polls.
And the president, by the way, supports it, too.
On the other hand, it's not new that we have this rule in the Senate that on controversial legislation like this, you have to get 60 votes. That's
right.
Not
well,
something that's suddenly been imposed. And I think it is unlikely you can get 60 votes for a real public option, maybe for a trigger or for co-ops or for one of the other compromises that's been proposed. But I think the idea of a pure public option, even one with the state opt-out, is unlikely to get 60 votes.
If you took the insurance industry lobbyists out of the picture, I think you'd have 60 votes easy.
This is why you're having increasing pressure from the left on the president and on Congress for the so-called reconciliation tactic, because they realize that Mary Landrieu or Ben Nelson or some other Democrats might be on board, but there's certainly going to be more than 50 Democrats who would be on board to do this. So the question is 60 or 51. And if they do attempt the nuclear option, the reconciliation process in some way, it will bring a nuclear winner on Capitol Hill, but they might get what they want.
But that's as much of part of the rules as a filibuster.
Actually, reconciliation has never, ever, ever been used on a bill like this.
Well, of course, the Bush tax cuts were pushed with reconciliation.
Tax cuts can be undone. You lower taxes, you increase taxes, and reconciliation was specifically done for fiscal reasons.
Okay, what about Nancy Pelosi's statement about taking away the antitrust exemption for health insurance companies?
You know, health insurance companies have had antitrust protection since the 19th century.
Right.
And because the Supreme Court held that insurance is not interstate commerce, so that there would be no federal regulation of it. And then it's not that insurance companies are not regulated. They're regulated by the states. Now, in 1944, the Supreme Court strips that away, and then Congress the next year gives it back. So they've had this current system of antitrust protection since 1945. My sense of this is, maybe they should have it, maybe they shouldn't have it. In this context, this is an example of Democrats trying to wreak retribution on the insurance companies. The insurance companies are the villain of the moment. So Henry Waxman, a few months ago, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, demanded that insurance companies cough up their most secret financial documents. Why? Because he just wanted them.
But why should the insurance companies have this antitrust exemption?
And that is a question a lot of Democrats on Capitol Hill are asking. It looks like Democrats are pretty much united on this front, and there is a good chance that the 60-year exemption is about to be taken away from the insurance industry.
Do you interpret it, as Byron does, as retribution?
Well, maybe it's a recognition of the insurance companies are definitely the villains of today for opposing this last stage for Democrats in this last stage of the health care debate. On the other hand, there is, I think, a legitimate debate over whether this industry deserves antitrust
exemptions. Just not at
exemptions,
this moment.
Especially at a time when we know now from watching this debate that there are any number of states where there's no competition with insurance companies, and that's been a factor in the debate.
That's part of the problem.
Because you're vilified doesn't mean you're not a villain.
Make us laugh,
yeah,
doesn't
but he? I think you know, you ask anyone in your family, you can come up with stories about insurance companies that even rival nightmare stories of dealing with cable companies. I mean, these companies are, you know, this is the problem. They produce a commodity that is essential to our well-being, you know, protecting our health. And they treat it, you know, with the profit motive like a commodity, and they make money when they deny coverage. The system is backwards, and so to give them even special protection in our capitalist society doesn't make any sense.
All right, let me take you all on to the implications of the Senate blocking the Medicare doc fix. Susan, explain that to me.
You know, this was a big vote. Didn't get that much attention, but I think very significant. On Wednesday, the Democrats got only 47 votes for a measure Harry Reid was backing that would have made this Medicare fix. Now, the fact is, for years, the law has said that Medicare doctors are going to get less reimbursement as a cost-saving measure. And every year, Congress does a fix so that you don't actually impose this cost-saving measures on doctors, because we know that there are already any number of doctors who won't take Medicare patients, and members of Congress are concerned about that. Harry Reid wanted to pass this Medicare fix without paying for it, and he wanted to do it without including it in the overall health care bill, because it makes the overall health care bill more expensive. And all the Republicans and some of the Democrats refused to go along with him.
Byron.
If after this you have any faith that under health care reform the government would cut $450 billion out of Medicare over the next 10 years, I think you're not being realistic. This is a simple situation in which Congress has many times in the past decided that they have to cut what doctors are paid or what goes into Medicare, and then at the last minute they change their minds and those cuts don't happen. And so the idea that the half of health care reform could be paid for by these cuts, these efficiencies and savings to be found in Medicare, I think is just absolutely unrealistic.
I think they were due for a 21% cut or so, which is pretty draconian, even by Republican standards. And so and each year they say, no, we're not going to do this. And now what they're doing is passing a bill, as Susan says, that will make it permanent so they don't have to do it every year. But that still doesn't foreclose the possibility of finding the cost savings in other ways which are already, you know, proceeding. Because I don't think that these cuts are figure into the overall savings over the next 10 years because no one expected them to kick in anyway.
Cost $250 billion over the next 10 years, and they didn't offer any offsets. This is this comes at a time when people, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, are concerned about the rise in federal spending, the growing federal budget deficit. It just wasn't a climate where even a lot of Democrats were willing to pass this kind of expensive measure without saying how you're going to pay for it.
Because in part, one of the great criticisms of the Bush-era Medicare prescription drug plan was that the Republicans just passed this plan without any pay-fors, although Democrats were actually pushing for a more extensive plan at the time. Anyway, the idea of passing a big quarter trillion dollar program without any payment is just not going to fly right now.
Byron, you're a key chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Susan Page is Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and a frequent guest host on this program. David Korn is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine and a blogger and works for PoliticsDaily.com. And one more story on the healthcare side. The New York Times had a story this week that the American Cancer Society is somehow reconsidering its screening guidelines for both breast and prostate cancer. When we talk to the ACS, they say they're not really reconsidering, but there is a question as to whether some of these early screening results should indicate massive action.
You know, early screening for a lot of cancers has been a big success story because it catches cancer when they're better able to be treated before they're so advanced. But the data does not support that to the same degree for breast cancer and prostate cancer. It hasn't shown the same, early detection has not shown the same decline in death rates, some decline, but not as extensively. And some doctors and researchers, including a report that prompted the Cancer Society to take a look at this, concludes that when you catch some of these cancers very early, you're treating cancers that you don't need to treat, that nothing will happen, maybe they won't grow. And so there's some question about under what circumstances, for which cancers,
exactly,
do you really want to push for extensive?
And we're confused.
Yeah, we should note, according to this Times story earlier this week, which was a bit confusing,
that
with colon and cervical cancers, the researchers believe that early screening does make a difference. And they see this in the numbers. If you screen things earlier, then there should be fewer fatalities at the end for certain cancers. And they see that correlation between in colon and cervical cancer,
but
they
not.
Don't see it in breast cancer and prostate cancer. And so, and that's the issue. I mean, for a long time, there have even been some researchers who have said that with breast cancer, that sometimes the screening, the mammograms, can even aggravate the cancer and make it worse. So, there's been a lot of controversy for years on this. And I think the American Cancer Society, or the story about them, has just made the picture a little bit more confusing.
Fuzzy.
And just a couple of lines from the story. In the case of prostate cancer, for every 100 men with diagnoses, as many as 70 have cancers that, if left untreated, would never have harmed them.
Exactly.
So I think the reaction across the country was, what? I mean, we've been told to get tested all the time.
And early treatment.
And early treatment is the key.
Well,
and
forgive me if I'm
now
wrong.
We're being told, never mind.
Didn't the old research indicate that as many as 90% of men at death, even in their 90s,
right,
were diagnosed with prostate cancer?
Exactly. You're in your 90s, you die, you have congestive heart failure, which kills you, but you've also got a slow-growing prostate cancer,
exactly,
which you may have had for 20 years, but was never going to be the end of
so
you.
So we've clearly got to look more and more at this and understand more clearly what this research indicates.
And I think right now it puts the American Cancer Society in a little bit of a pickle, because the story comes out, they say they aren't reconsidering, but maybe they are.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So they need to clarify. And if the picture is indeed fuzzy from a scientific perspective, they have to let the public know that.
All right, let's talk about different kinds of cuts. Treasury's proposed cuts, and the question is, Byron, for whom?
Well, for Treasury, that's for the executives of AIG, Citigroup, Bank of America, General Motors, Chrysler, and the two finance arms.
Why?
Why? Because they have enormous capital infusions from the U.S. government. AIG is 80% owned by the U.S. government. This is kind of understandable that there was going to be a crackdown on executive pay at these particular companies. I think it's important to remember, though, the government is moving on two fronts about executive pay. One is the Treasury Department, where we heard from the pay czar this week, and the other is the Federal Reserve, which has come up with less coercive guidelines, but really would affect all banks under their supervision. These are guidelines. They're not actually orders. But I think that part is very, very troubling.
You know, the idea, though, is not to cut pay. It's to change incentives. So the effect of these actions by both the Fed and by the Treasury Department this week is to make it riskier financially for bankers and others to do the riskiest financial transactions, so that you wouldn't get a bonus in cash when you made a big profit. You'd get stock that you couldn't sell for a while. So you're more invested in the long-term prospects for your company. And that seems to me to be something that makes sense. I mean, what this is really stems from is the feeling that some of these business interests got millions of dollars by putting our entire economy at risk, and that we've all paid the price.
But
are the cuts legal, David? There are some indications that some of these could be decided by lawsuits.
Well, you know, if Bank of America wants to be held in even more disregard than it is already, I advise them to take the federal government to court on this. I mean, there may be cases, legal cases, but right now I think Wall Street is pretty lucky. I think the level of populist anger that there is out there towards big finance is maybe not as intense or sharply defined as it should be. It's kind of diffuse. People have a hard time understanding derivatives and even these new agencies that are being created here in Washington. But the one thing they do understand, the one thing that continually ticks people off, is exorbitant corporate compensation.
And we did yesterday a program on these derivatives. For those of you who'd like further clarification, I suggest you go online, go to our archives, and listen to that program. It was most enlightening. Why aren't firms like Goldman Sachs on that list?
So, can I go back to the answer to your question about whether they're legal?
Absolutely.
No, some of them are not legal because some of these executives are working under contracts that were made before all of these bailouts happened. So the question to the fact that the government can go in before it's ever taken the bailout action and void that contract is should be troubling to a lot of people. And then
these
also on
the very act,
though, when Susan was talking about incentives, the very act of bailing out these companies and declaring some of them too big to fail is the biggest perverse incentive in the world because it tells people no matter what we do, the government will bail us out. So that's, I think, probably the worst incentive that we've seen in the past couple
of years. So what about Goldman Sachs? Why isn't Goldman Sachs on that list?
Well, because half the administration came from Goldman Sachs.
Well, no, do you mean on the Treasury list?
Yeah.
Didn't they take the seven companies that got the most money from the federal bailout funds? I think that's how they determined them.
So is this ruling going to make a real difference in total compensation? Because they're talking about pay packages, but then you've got all this retirement money and bonus.
And I think they're talking about 175 executives total. I mean, it's not, I mean, you know, it's important, but it's also symbolic. And there are far more structural, more significant structural things that could be done to prevent what happened in the past and to try to make Wall Street less of a casino run by only 30 people who understand what they're doing for their own benefit.
What about the argument that if you cut back on these pay allowances or benefits, that these executives are going to go elsewhere?
Well, there's a risk for that because, for instance, hedge funds don't fall under the new Fed rules that are supposed to regulate executive pay. But you're still going to have multi-million dollar payouts, but the mix might be different. You might get less money and more stock. I think it makes actually some sense to not have people be held harmless when they do very risky behaviors. So they get a big payout if it succeeds, but they don't pay any price if it doesn't. It seems to me this makes some sense that they should be invested in the long-term interest. They're still going to be, but you know, people who see this as a totally populist move to keep these guys from getting big payouts, I don't really think that's what it's intended to do. You're still going to have these guys making millions and millions of dollars.
Byron.
What you were referring to earlier is Ken Lewis, who's the departing CEO of Bank of America, who's going to depart with a $70 million retirement package. And that's just going to happen. And the pay of many of these people, I think, is still going to average $5 or $6 million.
But you know, Byron, you say it's just going to happen. This guy helped ruin a good part of the economy. You know, a couple months ago, I think 2 months ago, 10 CEOs met at the White House, including Ken Lewis, with the president. Afterwards, they came to the microphones that you've all seen on TV in front of the West Wing there. And, you know, people were asking questions about policy matters. And when it came to my turn, I just said to them, do any of you think you owe an apology to Americans for what you did to the economy? And they all looked down at their $600 pair of shoes, and no one said anything. I mean, at some point you can say, listen, if you run a company into the ground, you know, and we're going to bail out that company, we're only going to bail you out if you void your past agreements with your CEOs so they leave only with maybe $6 million instead of $60
million. You know what it reminds me of is the tobacco executive standing there in front of Congress
lying,
saying tobacco is not addictive.
The important thing on this populist rage stuff is to limit it to the companies that have received bailout money. That's why I think what the Federal Reserve is talking about is much more troubling than what we're seeing now. The incentive now to the bailed out companies is to get rid of this federal money. They should pay it back with interest and then go off and do what they want to. But the idea of regulating all of their pay, the pays of all banks who are under the purview of the Federal Reserve, is really a bad, bad precedent.
Okay. Somebody, Steve from Milwaukee, is asking, what is the status of the unemployment insurance bill in the Senate.
Well, there's some discussion on whether to once again extend unemployment benefits, and I think that is likely to happen. You know, we see everybody in Washington trying to figure out how to address this high jobless rate. Warning this week from the president's top economic advisor that it's likely to top 10% next year and stay there for some time. So this is one of the measures that Congress could do without too much tumult, and I think that is likely to happen.
All right. There's been a lot of talk this week about an Obama administration enemies list. David Korn, you've
Will
written
somebody
about it.
Please get Senator Lamar Alexander a history book. He's out there saying, you know, Obama's turned into Richard Nixon. Nixon actually talked about bombing and breaking into the headquarters of the Brookings Institution, God forbid, that radical outpost. I mean, as for whatever you say about Obama and Fox, I don't think yet they're talking about bombing the Fox Bureau in Washington.
But you did write that you felt that the Obama administration should not have taken this on.
What I said, and actually, if people want to go to my Twitter feed, I'll post the link. It's David Korn, D.C. I wrote a piece saying that I don't think the White House should play chicken with Fox, meaning that if you don't take Fox seriously as a news organization, then don't take them seriously. You know, deal with them with strategic derision. Don't take them on head on. You're wasting too much of your own time. You're building them up. And I think they should do it with a lighter touch.
All right. Dan, here's an email from James on that, who says, I think it's great that Fox's ratings are going up as a result of White House statements. Republicans are not gaining because of this. Fox is. And at around 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Byron York, what's your thinking?
Well, as a Fox News contributor, I think this is a bad idea. But I think yesterday you saw the White House go a little bit too far. The White House was offering up Mr. Feinberg, the pay czar, for interviews to each of the networks, the five networks in the White House pool. And the White House decided to offer Mr. Feinberg up to everybody except Fox. And the other networks said, no, you're going to have to do it with all of us. I think what happened yesterday was the other networks realized that, you know, if we make them mad, the same thing could happen to us, and they decided to put a stop to that.
I think that kudos to the bureau chiefs of the other networks that got together and said this was unacceptable, even though it gave them a little bit of a competitive advantage. You know, I think it's fine for the White House to jawbone against Fox. And if Fox won't put Obama's news conference on the air, to not put an administration official on this Fox Sunday show. But I thought what we saw happen at Treasury yesterday was disturbing. And I think presidents are well served by talking to journalists.
To everybody.
And talking to everybody. And well served by talking to outlets they think are hostile to them.
But didn't George W. Bush do the same thing?
George W. Bush did the same thing to the New York Times. For the last several years of his term, the New York Times got no interviews with George W. Bush. So every president has had outlets they like and dislike. I just think there are limits to what a president ought to be doing in terms of what is a news organization.
I agree with you, but I think, though, if you're talking about, you know, reacting to the New York Times versus reacting to Fox, I mean, Fox is clearly taking a much more confrontational approach than the New York Times news pages did, which printed a lot of stories that helped the Bush administration justify the war in Iraq. So, I mean, you know, while it's not exactly a comparable situation, although, you know, both White Houses, as have other White Houses in the past, you know, pick and choose their journalistic enemies for their own political strategic reasons.
The key thing that happened, we now know, is the White House became afraid that stories that originated on Fox would spread to other networks. And one of the key big issues was the case of Van Jones, the president's environmental advisor, who resigned after lots of statements in his radical past that he had made. It was a story that Fox had pushed very hard, and the networks and the other other news organizations did not cover until Jones actually resigned. What happened was the Times later said, you know, we should have been on this story earlier. We should have noticed it earlier, and we're going to keep an eye on these things. That set off alarm bells in the White House, which meant, my goodness, if Fox does a story and then the New York Times feels like it has to pay attention, where does it stop? So they decided to try to, A, stigmatize Fox, and then say to all of the other news organizations, you don't want to be with them, do you? My goodness, they are beyond the pale.
But this
and
is
that's the divide and conquer strategy that's falling apart
this
right
now.
This
is also a network that basically tried to rally support for anti-Obama demonstrations, which is their right to do. I mean, they can be as conservative. I was a Fox News contributor a few years ago, and they have the right to be as conservative and to be as inaccurate as they want to be. But it doesn't mean a White House has to sort of, you know, give them serious regard. You know, they've done a series of stories that are false during the campaign. They really pushed the Obama is Osama line and the terrorist fist bumps. I mean, you can come up with easily three dozen examples of when they made mistakes that all worked towards the disadvantage politically of the Obama campaign or administration. And I don't think you could find that really with others.
Susan, last word.
You know, I think it also serves a purpose for the White House of kind of ginning up the liberal base of the party.
Right.
And amid some speculation, is Obama tough enough to be president,
that's
as
right.
The National Journal asked last week, this makes the White House look like they're willing to take on a fight.
Susan Page, David Korn, Byron York, do join us. We'll take your calls right after a short break. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By the Gruber Family Foundation to extend the breadth and depth of NPR's international coverage. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. A date is set for a runoff election in Afghanistan, and China's economy grew at close to 9% last quarter. A panel of journalists on these and other top international news of the week. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to go to the phones, 800-433-8850. Now to Clayton, North Carolina. Marina, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I think the Obama administration is trying to save face for the mishandling of the bailout, giving all that money without a comprehensive contract in which there were limits and rules on how to use the money. Now, shareholders are usually the ones that vote on compensation packages and bonuses for CEOs. And, you know, consumers took a gambling investment. It has an inherited risk in investing. And people were not complaining when they were doing a lot of money. And now, after the fact, they are crying for the money that they put in risk and they lost.
Well, I have to agree with some of that. Clearly, the Obama administration has not handled this all that well. And this is, you know, surfing on this wave of populist rage about compensation packages is a good way, for example, to and attacking Fox News are a good way to kind of divert attention from the fact that unemployment's almost 10% going to stay that way for the whole next year.
Here's an email from Ed, who says, let's see, the PAYSAR's limitations on income to federally subsidized executives makes sense. However, I've heard Barney Frank would like to see this extended throughout the private sector. Is there any realistic possibility of this happening? As a small businessman and medical device entrepreneur, this sort of government intrusion scares me to death. This sounds like something Rush Limbaugh would imply.
I think he's been listening to Glenn Beck. I don't think there's anybody talking about imposing these sort of limits on small business entrepreneurs who are making innovative medical devices. So you need not worry. The Fed has put out rules, as we talked about earlier, for banks that go beyond the bailed out banks, and I think that really focuses on about 28 or so banks. So I think they're still pretty far away from the caller's business, and I don't think anybody is.
But we might get there.
Well, no. What Barney Frank is,
Glenn Beck probably thinks we will, but
what is Barney Frank saying?
What Barney Frank has talked about is giving shareholders a little more of a voice in the compensation for executives at publicly held firms, and perhaps that's what Ed's referring to.
Well, you know, Obama, when he was senator, pushed a bill that would allow shareholders on their own to introduce resolutions that would limit corporate pay, but in a voluntary way. The CEOs and the board could still, deny these shareholder resolutions. And that was opposed by the financial services industry. So right now, it's not easy. You can't just say it's up to shareholders. Actually, shareholders often are thwarted when they try to rein in executive compensation.
But the principle of the government trying to limit the pay of companies in which the government doesn't have a capital stake, has not bailed out, everybody should be nervous about that. You shouldn't like that.
The government regulates banks. If they see a risk factor involved in high compensation packages, especially if they're designed in a way, as Susan said earlier, to encourage risky behavior on the part of CEOs, and I think then that's part of the regulatory process.
Bailouts encourage risky behavior.
That's right. So, you are saying you want to protect the CEOs and their pay packages and not have the bailouts?
David, Byron,
I'm saying
enough to Fort Worth, Texas. Michael, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diana.
Good morning.
Seem to be sounding a little better. I hope you're feeling better.
I am indeed.
Well, good to hear. Good to
Thanks.
Hear.
Thanks.
Listen, my initial point was where would these guys' contracts be if the bailouts hadn't happened? But I also want to point out that a lot of people seem to be forgetting these bailouts happened before President Obama took office. He wasn't really complicit in all of what happened as far as getting them going, you know?
Well, that's true, Michael. It's a good point to remember.
All right. Thanks for
calling. I think Hank Paulson came up with a 3-page, application process for tens and hundreds of billions of dollars.
All right. To Potomac, Maryland, Graciela, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking my call, Anne. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I have really a big problem with insurance companies, and I hope that one point the government will regulate them. You pay for years your premium, and when you get sick, they choose what to pay or not what to pay. I had cancer, and if it had not been for my husband, probably I would not be talking. And afterwards, they had the pleasure of dropping me. My husband, on the other hand, is a physician. He's not one of these high-paid physicians, is a regular physician. When the insurance companies pay, they pay 30, 60, 90 days late, and they pay only 30%, 40% of the bills. And I think, again, that insurance companies should be regulated. When it comes to Medicaid, sometimes we take Medicaid, But sometimes, no, because on a bill, they pay 10%, 15% after the doctor has spent his half an hour, 1 hour, hour and a half with a patient. Okay? So, and I would like to know when the CEOs are going to go, when they are going to be treated by lawyers and not doctors, because mm-hmm. doctors are becoming a species that is being exterminated.
Could I ask one question of Graciela? Do you think that the current Democratic proposals under consideration in the House and the Senate for health care reform would fix this problem?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. And instead of coming to an agreement with lawyers, they should invite more doctors, or more doctors, not the ones that are, in, you know, activists, but you should invite doctors that are Washington, D.C. A lot of doctors are leaving Washington, D.C. because of the regulations.
Well, I think that what this points to me is, you know, it's often said that Republicans have no plans at all for health care reform. There are two or three things that can be done to make the health care system better. There could be portability of insurance across state lines. There could be an end to the perverse tax incentive for people who the difference between people who get their health insurance through work and those who are self-employed, and there can be pre-existing conditions changes. If you fix those three things, and by the way, there could have been a bill passed on that yesterday, you would make an enormous improvement in the system without this enormous change that Democrats are considering.
All right. We have an email from Aileen who says, I cannot believe you have not discussed Senator Franken's rape. It's
basically it allows people who work for military contractors in Iraq to basically sue their contractor if they are raped or harassed in the workplace, so to speak. This comes from a case. Janie Lee Jones? I'm sorry if I'm not getting the name exactly right now, because actually we've written about this at Mother Jones.
And she says that 30 senators voted against
yes,
the legislation.
This was a woman who worked for KBR contractor, part of Halliburton in Iraq, and she alleged that she was held in a trailer for days and raped by her fellow co-workers. And when this ordeal was done for her, she found she could not sue KBR or Halliburton because in her contract was an arbitration clause put in there. You're not going to believe this, but when Dick Cheney was the head of Halliburton and he imposed these arbitration clauses. And so Al Franken, one of his first major acts as a senator, was to introduce legislation that would make it possible, that would basically strip these arbitration clauses and make it possible for people in that position to sue their employer and to say we have the presumption of a safe workplace even in a war zone.
Wow. Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Thomas.
Hello. I'm calling actually from Washtenaw County that surrounds Ann Arbor and contains two of the most important and prestigious public universities in the nation, the University of Michigan and Eastern Michigan University. And I'm calling in to challenge President Obama and the Democratic leaders of Congress to reframe their agenda and specifically the health care debate to emphasize public service. We need a public service health care reform act.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think President Obama is emphasizing more public service.
Certainly been a theme of his from the campaign, and also a theme of Michelle Obama's, the need for public service, the value of public service. I think that is something we've heard from the White House.
All right. To Brentwood, New Hampshire. Good morning, Marty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to emphasize the journalistic aspect of the coverage of the health care reform debate, which to me, as an educated layman, the most glaring fact is that every other advanced country in the world has 100% universal coverage, better health care, and half the cost of what Americans are going to be settling for. even under the whatever they're going to pass soon. And I think every story, whether you're a liberal or progressive or a conservative, could begin with something like, why are Americans being looted by protectionist policies that protect the insurance companies, the providers, the drug makers?
Byron.
I would prefer not to begin my stories with why are Americans being looted by these protectionist policies. I don't want to be flip about this, but I think that the president and Democrats in Congress all acknowledge that the United States is a unique country. It has a unique situation. It's a very big country. It has 50 states. It has constitutional provisions that make some things not possible. So even the president, who said that maybe if we could start over, that he would prefer a single-payer health plan. That's his way of explaining the fact that he used to say he was a proponent of a single-payer health plan, that we can't do it now. So I think that even Democrats who are very, very strongly in favor of the bills on the table right now say that that is not a particularly good analogy.
But it actually is a good measuring yard, a good measuring yardstick, in that if you compare us with other countries, and there's nothing wrong to do that. We're not number one in health care. We're not number one in health. We think we are an exceptional country in many ways. Indeed, we are. But when it comes to, covering most people in this country and taking care of most diseases, we do not do as good a job as many other Western industrialized states. And so if we're trying to be the last great hope of the planet, we have a long ways to go. We should be a little modest when we think about ourselves as a society.
Then why are Democrats designing bills that would leave 10 to 25 million people unemployed even after they were enacted?
Well, excuse me. They're trying to cover more people than any Republican ever has.
All right.
But the caller was talking about universal 100% health care.
I'm sorry if they don't get 45 million people covered and it's only 30 million people, because either way, Byron, you oppose it. So don't say now that you'll be happier if
Enough.
10 million people are covered.
Enough. Let's go to Dayton, Ohio. Wayne, you're on the air.
Morning. Great show, Diane.
Thank you.
I think the Obama strategy to stay off Fox is brilliant. The Republican right's been outrageously abrasive, and this kind of snapshots the problem and will catch the Republicans as they try to come back into the fold to go for the independents by the next election. By the time that they do that, they'll meet Obama in the center, and no matter what you say, he is kind of a centrist, except for a couple key issues. And it will highlight the fact that the Republicans really don't have anything different than Obama to run the country.
That's a very interesting theory. I think that's perhaps a little bit too ornate for what's actually going on. I think the White House is trying to gin up support with its base, with the Democratic base, which really doesn't like Fox. There have been anti-Fox documentaries produced and distributed by MoveOn.org. This is a very popular position from that point of view. The president's also going out and doing a lot of fundraising these days, and that doesn't hurt that with that either.
Let's go to Pembroke Pines, Florida. Hamie, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane.
Morning, sir.
Show this morning.
Thanks.
I wanted to say the following. It's mind-boggling to me how our young people, when they may refuse to fight for this country, are treated as treason and sent to jail, yet when we're talking about CEOs that not only hurt a company, but actually are running the risk of running this country bankrupt, are left to walk away unscathed, basically, from a personal perspective.
Byron?
I didn't get the first part. I mean, we have a volunteer military.
Well, but he's really talking about the CEOs and how much they are being compensated despite the fact that they brought the country.
Well,
where do you
draw the line? What if the CEO said, maybe he makes $25 million. Let's say I'm going to make $500,000. Would that be okay? And then he wouldn't have to go to jail? Or, I mean, how punitive do you want to get? The way to fix this is to get that money back with interest from these financial organizations.
All right. I want to end this program first by talking about Jack Nelson, who died this week. He and his wife, Barbara Mattis, good, dear friends. You knew Jack Nelson.
I did. I knew Jack Nelson as the person who built the L.A. Times, the Los Angeles Times, Washington Bureau, into a real powerhouse. But I was struck in reading a book about the civil rights era about the role he also played during the 60s as a reporter in the South, doing some groundbreaking coverage, some very brave coverage of the fight there. There's one anecdote about him trying to get some information going into a coroner's office and saying he was Nelson from Atlanta, as though this was something very official. They gave him the autopsy reports he wanted, which showed some real wrongdoing. Anyway, a great reporter, and we'll miss him.
He won the Pulitzer Prize as a reporter for the Atlanta Constitution in 1960. Now, I just want to let listeners know I'll be gone for the next 3 weeks, going to take that fabulous trip to Egypt with 120 NPR listeners. I'll be back the 17th of November. Susan will be sitting in for me for part of that time. Thanks for listening, all. Have a great 3 weeks. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.